Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Valerie Martin. I haven't seen Valerie in around 20 years. I'm so happy. She's written around 11 novels. I like each new one more than the last, and I love the new one, which is called The Ghost of the Marie Celeste. Now, this is a story, a legend, a historical event. Tell me the story of the Marie Celeste.
The Marie Celeste is actually the Mary Celeste.
Thank you.
But you're not alone in calling it the Marie Celeste, and there's a reason for that, which is part of the plot of the story, because it was called the Marie Celeste by Conan Doyle in the story that he wrote, so the names got conflated.
This was as a young writer. The inventor of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, wrote a story based upon these events.
These events, and these are the events. In 1872, off the coast of the Azores, a ship named the Mary Celeste, which was a ship that had sailed from New York about 3 weeks earlier, and the captain had his wife and baby daughter aboard, and there was a small crew. There were only 10 people altogether. The ship turned up sailing in the wrong direction, some sails up, and the lifeboat missing, although it's never really been determined that there was a lifeboat. And there was no one on the ship, and there was no reason to leave. They had evidently left in a hurry. So the ship that picked up that ship and put two sailors on it and sailed it into Gibraltar, and there was a salvage hearing. And that hearing went on for 3 months. And it was a very famous trial, especially in Britain. A thing I've noticed is that a lot of Americans have never heard of the Mary Celeste, but when I was in Britain and even in Scotland recently, everyone, as soon as you said Mary Celeste, they knew the story that I just told you.
Now, when I close my eyes, the picture I get is a ghost ship by which I had always taken it to mean a ship sailing in a silent ocean, no people. It seems as if the stock of the ship, what they were carrying, was not rifled or stolen.
No, it was eventually delivered.
Yes. There were not signs of violence.
No.
It was a ship fully masted.
Some sails were down. They had made a few efforts to, apparently, take down sail. But they left enough up so that it was very dangerous to leave the ship in that condition. And they didn't lash the wheel, which is usually done by routine when a ship is abandoned. So it was not abandoned properly, and that was another thing that was very mysterious, because the captain was an experienced captain. And no one could believe he would have done that.
How long was it thought that the ship had been at sea?
Oh, they know exactly how long it had been. I think altogether they had been sailing about 3 weeks, and then the ship sailed on its own. Probably about 2 weeks. They have the last log entry is presumably the day they left, though we can't prove that either.
Now, Valerie Martin, who as a writer thrillingly has the last word, she famously wrote a book from the point of view of the servant in the house of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, Mary Riley. You retell the story and tell us all kinds of things about the kinds of American families that went generation after generation to sea. The ship becomes a house in a certain way. Again and again, a wife will ship with her husband, leaving a child behind, and the story gets told and retold generation after generation, so literally what we read is the ghost of the Mary Celeste. The people become almost as if they're impositions over one another. There's a fog, there's a nimbus. The characters sometimes get renamed. One of them is known both as Sarah and as Sally. And we are sitting as we hear stories again and again, sometimes in letters, sometimes in a log. Sometimes the characters write love poems to one another. It's a mood that you begin to understand will take you off to sea. As Ishmael says at the beginning of Moby Dick, that you have to leave the land. And it's in search of, I think, a certain kind of invisible presence that will provide an image that will haunt history forever.
It is interesting that in the copy it says a ship appears in a mist. That mental picture of a ship in a mist is so affecting. And you may not know who's on the ship or where the ship came from. The ship may not be empty. You know, it may be, there may have been pirates. But there's something kind of visually and romantically appealing about the vision of a ship sailing empty into a mist, always in a mist, never on a clear day. It's that mist.
But also a tradition here of fathers giving their daughters notebooks to write down stories. And the daughters are, as they must be, impressionable. And the stories are often eerie. One of these daughters has a sister who is a medium. She, while she's hiding it from her father, a minister, that is to say, in this book, a minister is a practical man. It's a medium.
Yes, that's right. The visionary.
Exactly. And she writes about her sister's spells and trances and about her appearances giving consolation in spiritualist newspapers. And we're gradually being inducted into the world where the yearning for messages from the life to come is on the rise.
It's overwhelming. The period of the rise of spiritualism, especially in the United States, it started in New York, but it went everywhere. The interest in seances. Queen Victoria went to a seance. Abraham Lincoln went to a seance.
Houdini was famous.
Yeah, he and Conan Doyle fell out over the whole question of whether, in fact, you can talk to the dead. He put up prize money for anyone that could get a message from his dead mother. And Conan Doyle tried to win the prize, I guess, in a way. And they fell out over that. But, you know, there's a kind of sense that I had when I set out once again into this 19th century. In a way, setting out to write a novel is a little bit like getting on a ship. You don't know what you're going to encounter. I had a sense of the world of this novel and of many people who lived at that time as being a very haunted place and very much kind of between life and death on a thread all the time. And that the people who, the families who were involved in the sea trade is a very good place to look for this sense of life and death kind of in many ways so intermingled as to be almost impossible to pull apart. And the Briggs family of Marion, Massachusetts, are a perfect example. They had six children. The father was a captain. He had six children. Five died at sea, including his daughter. Two lost, two died of yellow fever. No, three lost, two died of yellow fever, including his granddaughter, who also disappeared on the Mary Celeste. So one child survived, two generations.
And these Victorians have created a new wrinkle in the ghost story.
Yes,
they
indeed.
Read the ghost story. They read it even in his comic novels. Dickens likes to insert ghost stories. In the Pickwick Papers, a ghost story is found in a drawer, and no time is wasted. Everyone sits about to read it. And this sense of haunting creates the image for Henry James. He writes in the Bostonians, no less a sensible place than Boston will be transfixed by medium speakers.
Yeah.
And in a certain sense, I'd like to say that the image of the Mary Celeste itself is a image from the other side.
Mm. That is a very good way of thinking about it, because whenever I have this mental picture of the ship floating towards the viewer through the mist, as in the cover of the book, it is as if it's coming from a place we can't go, and coming back to us in some ways, possibly with a message. I like that notion.
I'm talking to Valerie Martin about her book, The Ghost of the Mary Celeste. Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, is a character here. Mm. In a certain way, he's inadequate to the task. Like me, he mistakes the name of the ship. He calls it the Marie Celeste. But more than that, he can't resist it. He's a man of his times, whether in England or America. He places the responsibility on a black man.
Right.
He is a racist. He is amazed to see black people at sea and in positions of dignity. And his story is a story in which the darkness is responsible for death, confusion, destruction. It's very much of its time.
It's like Conrad in Africa, the heart of darkness.
The heart of darkness. Mm-hmm. But you're an anti-racist, anti-imperialist writer. And so you're rescuing, in a certain sense, these images of history's darkness from assumptions that underlie the Conan Doyles of the world.
Well, you know, Conan Doyle was a complicated man. He was a racist, as many people were in his time, but he actually had been to Africa, which many had not. As a young man, he said some rather blatant and shocking things about how he felt about the black man. But in fact, he was very impressed with Henry Garnett, who was the black abolitionist that he met on that ship. Interesting to me was that he didn't seem to have noticed that Henry Garnett had one leg, the great creator of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, the hilarious aspect of his appearance here is that he's not observative.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny, and it was what I noted in his own autobiography and in his letters. He's very observant of physical details, but he misses a lot. One of the things people who knew him sort of despaired of when he became so taken up with spiritualism and was constantly going to seances. One of his friends went with him and said, you know, he gives himself away. The medium will say, I'm hearing a voice from someone whose name is Weather, I think Weather. And Conan Doyle would say, Weatherstone. So he was very childlike in a way. But he was very obsessed with honor. Probably the best portrait of him is Barnes, it's Arthur and George, it's called, George Ajali, who was a Pakistani Parsi convicted of a crime that he didn't commit. And Conan Doyle spent a lot of energy, time, and money trying to get him acquitted and ultimately did get him released from prison. Well, as you know, for Britons, an Indian and an African are the same thing. They're all. So it was a situation in which he got beyond his natural antipathy for people of color because he couldn't bear the injustice that he saw. So he wasn't so simple.
And it's a book that excavates a whole lot of different ghost stories, love stories, family chronicles, gruesome deaths at sea. It's, in its way, a book that wants to create the illusion of a book like this.
I really like that.
I do too.
Yes, I think I want to write that down. I am trying to create the illusion of a book like this, because the deeper I got into it, the more it became clear to me that I have strong feelings about history. I don't trust it. When people talk about historical fiction, their anxiety that everything might not be true always comes up, and I want to come out strongly for that word fiction in the part that says historical fiction in the title Historical Fiction. I mean, it's not all true. But I also have the sense when I'm reading that thing, which is called history, that a lot of it's not true either. It's always written with an agenda. And stories get wrapped up inside stories, as was the case with this ship. Within weeks of its having been brought to Gibraltar, the misinformation that was in the press all over the world was enormous.
Well, you will pardon me then for saying that I think it's your intention to create this nest of illusions, that we have the Briggs family, but also the Gibbs family, and they're living next to one another, and cousins are marrying, and people...
Sadly, that's all exactly true.
I'm sure it is, but the result is that it creates an eerie sense of not... The reader is in an adventure in which he is never sure exactly that he has the story right. Mm-hmm. The effect is one of delight and surprise, and you are given sudden clarities. You know, suddenly there's a clearing, and we say, that's who they are. Yes, I get it now. But that, I think, is to say that life is a ghost story, that we're haunted by our relatives and the things we overhear and the things we knew about our parents and our grandparents, and that moments of clarity come, and that these are how this book has been, in a way, constructed to enact our falling into enchantment. You're against enchantment, but you recognize that life contains in it, well, look at your own work. Life contains in it not mermaids, but stories about mermaids. Mm-hmm. It contains the book Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It contains that weirdest of all horrors, the figure of the slave. Mm-hmm. Reality is not real enough. In Valerie Martin, those aspects of the real become the occasion, for stories to weave together between reality, nightmare, fiction, and subjectivity.
Yeah, I think what I'm finally coming to, because I spent a while trying to think of myself as a realist, which for people who've read my work, it's really funny. But I think that what I'm finally coming to, especially in thinking about what the novel is that it's all real. You know, surrealism is so different from magical realism, because in surrealism, the dream and the waking, it's all one thing. It's just... there's no separation. In magical realism, magical things occur inside a world that we can believe is solidly there. And I'm getting to the point where I'm pulling more towards the notion that it's all real, and it all makes up our vision of the world. I mean, each person has a vision of what reality is, and each person clings to that version of reality really strongly. I don't believe in ghosts. If one crops up in my room, it could happen. I'm going to resist. But others will give in right away and in fact feel gratified or special because they had a vision. It's a whole question of what it means to have a vision and whether you should trust a vision or what you call enchantment, whether you should enter or whether you should say, no, I have my feet on solid ground and I know that that is not real.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Valerie Martin about her book, The Ghost of the Mary Celeste. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Valerie Martin about her new book, The Ghost of the Mary Celeste, the compelling story of a ghost ship, its vanished crew, and the writer who would come to be world-renowned for misunderstanding the story. Now, one character does not seem to misunderstand the story. And as you build her and work with her, she becomes more and more complex. She is the medium.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me about her and how you feel about her.
I just love her.
She's a great character.
But I didn't at first. Someone told me recently that they were reading it and that they just hated her and couldn't wait for her to die. But no, I became very attached to her because she is someone who's making it up as she goes along. It's a very American thing to admire that. But she's someone who's kind of stumbled into a way of getting attention. And even though in some ways humiliating to her, she makes the best of it. She does, in a way, make the best of a very bad the situation that she stumbles into.
Her circumstance.
Yeah. She's a woman who doesn't have much money. You know, there were so many women in the spiritualist movement who became charismatics, and in some ways those women got connected to the later feminists. In fact, some of the great feminist mothers went to seances, and some of the charismatic speakers became feminist speakers. That's what Henry James's Bostonian is about. She starts as a charismatic speaker and then becomes a speaker for feminists. So it was a way for women to speak.
A way for women to speak, but not only that, this is a woman who's been disowned by her family, basically. She's had to go off on her own, and she's made her way in the world. There's a certain amount of pluck and wit and seductiveness. She knows how to write a letter that will bring its recipient right to her door.
Yeah.
And what happens behind the door is a form of seduction, because her eyes are so penetrating, her pertness and her knowledge. She reads. She knows about people. She knows what to expect from people in grief. And she knows enough about how to console them without giving way to lachrymosity, to tearfulness.
That's true. She's never sentimental.
She's
in her consolation. She's always rather surprised that she has been able to do it. Yeah, she's a great character.
She really is.
The more I followed her, the more I thought, you know, I think originally envisioned her as a charlatan and someone who the reader would feel relieved to see exposed. But the more I followed her, the more I thought, this is a kind of nerve that I find pretty amazing.
Not only nerve, but haven't you found that sometimes a reader or a literary critic, maybe Harold Bloom, reads so closely that they have visionary experiences of the books they read. That's what Violet Petra is
does
like.
With people.
Life is like a book, and she's reading it very, very deeply and very well. And it's what I would like to be thought of on this show. Someone who...
You're pretty penetrating.
I want that, you know, to remind readers that reading itself is a penetration and a seduction, that all of those sexual and impossible and difficult to speak words are at play. And I think that's what you want as a writer too, that there's a certain kind of, you want your reader to come next door to belief,
mm-hmm.
not to lose their footing, but to see what it would be like to fall.
Yes, to be subversive.
Yes, to be subversive, and I would say...
I want my book to be subversive. I wanted to do that unexpected thing of bringing you to a place that you would not normally have been quite willing to go, and then for you to feel, oh, I went there.
Yes, and have trouble shaking it off.
Yeah.
Yeah,
When I read a book that does that to me, and all the great works of literature do, there's something transgressive somewhere along the line where you think you want to draw away, but yet you go on. To me, that's the great power of fiction.
Well, your third book, which was When I Really Fell in Love, A Recent Martyr, was so full of perversity. And the word wasn't being used yet then, transgression.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always a suggestion that whatever the surface of a love relationship was, its depths were much different.
Mm-hmm. Darker.
Darker, unspeakable.
In this new novel, in The Mary Celeste, I actually have a love story that doesn't have a dark side.
It is
my first true love story.
I want to speak very highly of the book we're discussing, The Ghost of the Mary Celeste, by my guest, Valerie Martin, because it produces a very extraordinary effect. As it approaches you and you come to know its details, it's also simultaneously receding into the mist. And you feel that you've known something that is being withdrawn from you by the end of the book, and the book is haunting. Thank you, Valerie, for joining me.
Yes, thank you. thank you for that last observation, because that really is, I think, what I had in my mind, this haunted world that's constantly receding. In a way, that's both the future and the past for us because of our situation, which is that we live in the present.
I've been talking with Valerie Martin, author of The Ghost of the Mary Celeste, published by the Nanae Talese imprint at Doubleday. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Ghost of the Mary Celeste at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Jane Parshall. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Warren Lehrer is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.